Hi, I'm Renee.
And I'm Anthony. We are the voices and founders of Blue Soul Earth, where we teach and we lead workshops and retreats about heart-centered living and unity consciousness.
Welcome to Blue Soul Chats, a podcast that bridges science and spirituality. We combine esoteric wisdom and the experiences that people have had for millennia and beyond with the latest breakthroughs in science, health, cosmology, physics, and the arts.
In each episode, you'll tune into cutting-edge visionaries who are making a powerful dent in consciousness from different industries and cultures around the world.
Our interviews cross boundaries and at times break conventional thinking as we redefine what reality is, what spirituality means, and what consciousness does.
Your journey to connecting to your higher self, expanding your awareness, and deepening your consciousness starts here.
Welcome, welcome, everyone. We are here with Dr. Neha Sangwan, a friend of mine I met 10 years ago now when she graced our TEDx Berkeley stage. A little bit about her background. So she's an internal physician and the CEO of Intuitive Intelligence. She's also an author and an international speaker. And in her work, she empowers individuals, organizational leaders, and teams so they can be clear, effective communicators. But it doesn't stop there. In that process, she tackles the root causes of stress, miscommunication, and interpersonal conflict, which not only improves relationships and work and at home, but has also led to healing a lot of chronic conditions that many of us have experienced, right? Since this headaches, insomnia, anxiety, and depression. And on the personal front, she's also a first generation American who followed in her Indian parents' professional career footsteps. Well, sort of. we'll get to that. And as for how she landed on Blue Soul Summit, well, sometimes people find us, and other times there's a recommendation. And well, in our case, we've known each other for 10 years. But the biggest thing, right? So yeah, she's got the qualifications and the credibility. But what has really drawn me to her as a friend over so many years is her authenticity, her warmth, and her deep, deep commitment to serve others. As Wayne Dyer said about you, you're the real deal.
Thank you.
You really are the real deal. So thank you for being with us today.
What an honor. Happy to be here.
We thought we would start out a little bit, you know, rewind the clock a little bit, right? And to bring us to where we are today, you had spoken about a burnout earlier on in your career and one recently, which I was not familiar with, right? So, but the earlier burnout, right? And you didn't listen to the warning signals. You worked long shifts, and then you asked yourself, what signals did I miss? What else in my life needs to be healed? Which I love that question because a lot of us don't think about emotional healing, right? And then, right, if I spoke from the heart, what would I say? So, you know, some people call that the dark night of the soul. What emerged from that that sets you on the path of what you're doing today, where you're really merging medicine and your consulting work?
Well, thank you, Renee and Anthony, for having me. For those of you that are listening, I would say going through something that difficult opened up my heart to a new way of seeing the world. And just like my patients who would come in with a heart attack, a stroke, a pneumonia, those were the moments that seem like they're the biggest tragedy of their life. But what I experienced with them was a moment where their heart cracked open and the world looked different than they ever thought it could. They never thought they'd be the 52-year-old with cancer, the 65-year-old with a heart attack, you know, whatever it is. And so my version of that at 34 years old was burnout. I had just finished all my training. I thought I was, you know, just going to pay back all my loans and just at the pinnacle of everything that was happening. And to burn out and realize that my arms and legs could be working, but somehow I needed to be off work because I couldn't work, taught me really a lot about the grounded importance of honoring stress, of my mind becoming a bulldozer and overriding my body to the point that literally my body shut down and wouldn't function. And for somebody who helps other people come back from all of that, the prescription I was given was some time off, some version of the cocktail of Prozac, Ambien, and Ativan to take care of anxiety, depression, and insomnia. And I had a pretty forward-thinking doctor who basically said, we need to help you figure out how your behaviors are contributing to you not getting these signals earlier. And I think the most important thing there was I had grown up more worried about what society wanted for me. I didn't know what success meant to me. I knew what other people thought success meant in society. And I had everything in my life geared towards serving others, paying these loans back, buying a house in San Francisco, everything that I thought would make me one of the people in society that was seen as successful. And what I realized was I had never reflected on who I was and what I wanted and what I valued and in what order I valued those things. And so burning out, the beauty of it was I had to slow down. I thought going faster and faster was the game of the world, but really I learned slowing down was because when I slow down, it takes me out of reacting into responding and choosing. And I have a much wider foundation of emotions that I can choose from. And so I would say I learned that. I would say I also learned that stress causes or exacerbates more than 90% of all illness. And so the moment I learned that, I ran back to work when I was better. And I said, hey guys, if stress causes or exacerbates more than 90 to 95% of all illness, why are we not asking our patients once we've stabilized them physically? Why are we not asking them what's at the root of their stress? And my colleague said, just like you wouldn't order a test that you didn't know what to do with the result, nor would you ask a question that you didn't know what to do with the answer. And that really rocked my world. And I thought, we're really smart. We worked really hard. We've got to be able to answer this. And so it sent me on a journey for the last 20 years, basically trying to figure out what's at the root of people's stress and how, when we ignore our mental, emotional, social, spiritual worlds, do they sometimes show up in our physical world as insomnia, anxiety, headaches, all digestive issues, all sorts of ailments. And we go to an internal medicine doctor, which is what I am, and we say, can you please make this go away? And we act like everything physical has a physical cause. Sometimes it does. But when people tell you there's nothing more we can do for you, you are having a discomfort in your chest, and they say, oh, you have a clean bill of health, your heart is fine. It's true that you're not having a heart attack, but you got to trust your own body's wisdom, because the body never lies. It keeps score. It's telling you that something's wrong, but it might not be happening because of something physical. It might be happening because you're ignoring the anger in your relationship. It's because you're in a job that you've outgrown or a community that doesn't serve you. But you want to go a little bit deeper and get curious about how your body's communicating with you. That's really what I learned.
That's powerful, right? How your body's communicating with you, because it's alive. Right? Mm-hmm. It's alive. It's got all of this knowledge,
right?
You know, many call it the biofield, right? This energy field. In the East, they call it the auric field, whatever you want to call it. You know, our organs are alive, but we are so much more than just blood and bones and organs, right? We're so much more.
Now, could you mentioned something about your heart opening and the spiritual awakening of some sort, something happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to your heart spiritually? What happened to you emotionally after this you might say, this crash, this breakdown of who you are as an individual. What happened to you spiritually?
I would say I became much more open to seeing the world much bigger than physical ailments caused by physical causes. So it's like, I used to think like, okay, if somebody has pneumonia, they have a bug, they picked it up from somewhere. Now I look at it and I say, oh, wow, if I got pneumonia, what was I doing for the 3, 4, or 5 months prior to that, that I was running myself down? What was I worried about that was keeping me up at night? During sleep, your body isn't wasting time or sleep or resting. It's in fact in full cleanup mode. Your immune system is being repaired. Your memory is being consolidated. There's so many people who think that sleeping is a waste of time have no idea what goes on in your body when you sleep. And so I really began opening my mind. So I said my heart cracked open. It really did, in the sense of I was now willing to see the world. It's like I used to see the world in 2D in black and white, and now I see it in 3D HD color. That's like the best way I can say it. It's like I started being able to connect the dots between things that didn't seem connected or were never taught to me or were invisible. And so what I was saying is, you know, now I see that the months of stress that led up to my immune system not getting the rest and repair that it needed is probably what ended up leading to me getting a pneumonia or getting sick or getting a cold. So now I don't just think of it as like, oh, I picked up a bug. It's more like, oh, wow. What was my part in running myself down, in getting exhausted, in why did my body break down right here? What message does it need to send to me? What do I need to receive about how I can strengthen it? What message might I have been too busy to be receiving? And so now what does it do? It has me out in bed, right? I'm completely out. Well, now I'm going to slow down. Now everything's going to slow down so I can get the messages that I need to get.
You know, it's interesting because I sometimes think of physical illness as a way for us to purge some of the stuff that no longer serves us in a way, mm-hmm. as well, right? So when we are forced to go inward and just sit, we sleep more, we have to take in more liquids than maybe when we do otherwise. I mean, how many people, you know this as a doctor, probably 90% of us don't drink enough water, right? And so we face dehydration or so much more, right? That we can be healed with simply by drinking more water. So I think it's almost like your body's call to say, listen, you know, purge yourself from toxins, purge yourself from, you know, even things that we don't think about when we're so rushed in our life. Like as we get older, I call it the post 50 thing, right? Where you have like these joint pains, you're like, what's going on? Well, it's toxin buildup, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. People think it's woo-woo to talk about detoxing. That's like a California tree hugging experience. And I'm a little confused by that because no, it's kind of, it's biology. Just like if you stopped taking out the recycling or the trash in your house, like there's going to be an accumulation of you living in this place and you throwing paper out or whatever it is, unwrapping, you know, what items have come in, you've got to throw it away. So in our body, the most work we give our body every day is the food we put in our mouth that has to then be broken down into energy. And there's byproducts that are going on. That's just like a simple example. But when I think of like detox, I think of, okay, there's 5 main ways that the body gets rid of what it doesn't need. So the first one is air. So think of your lungs. I'm inhaling oxygen, I'm exhaling carbon dioxide. So there's a gaseous exchange. where I'm letting go of the carbon dioxide I need to release. The second one, you just spoke about liquid. So I'm taking in fresh filtered water. And the second organ would be my kidneys. They're flushing out and cleansing. The third way that I get rid of toxins in my body would be solid. So now we're talking my colon, my getting rid of solid waste from food. So I should be having 1 to 2 fluffy bowel movements each day to get rid of that waste. The fourth one would be your liver. Your liver is the detoxification powerhouse inside you. It's breaking down any pills you're taking, any supplements, all of lots and lots of aspects of your body go through your liver, right? Your blood flows through there and it gets cleaned. The fifth one is the largest organ, which is your skin. So it's you working out, sweating, you're literally letting go and expelling. And so to me, when people say, oh, that's so woo-woo, I think to myself, no, that was biology 101. But we've gotten so far away from it. What I would say is people who work out regularly take care of 4 of the 5 of them in the workout, right? So you're breathing deeper and heavier as you go for a run, right? You're drinking more water because you're thirsty when you get back to rehydrate. Your bowels are going to move more because you've helped the peristalsis that's going through your system because you're giving gravity and you're moving your body. So there's contraction and relaxation of muscles and you're sweating. So, you know, if you just took some liver support, you'd have the whole thing going just by working out. So, yeah.
And it also fires off your endorphins, right?
Yeah, it gives, and so you get feel good hormones, you start to feel really good. Yeah, absolutely. And then when you work out, it's all connected because when you work out, you break down ATP, your energy, you break that down, and then the adenosine goes up to your brain and helps you sleep better that night, right? So it's all part of a system. And just like when you're not doing it, right, multiple things start not working. And so the body's kind of, yeah, just incredible. We're just a bunch of feedback loops. You know, our body is a system, a very finely tuned machine that relies on feedback loops. And when something's wrong, that is almost like an error message on your computer, like error, like, sorry, like this isn't working. But we have become so accustomed to be outwardly focused that we miss those early signals that our body gives us. And so the body has to keep getting louder and getting louder. And ultimately, how loud it needs to get until we figure out what it is. And sometimes it's on a gurney, on a stretcher, having a heart attack. And sometimes it's us tuning in and catching it really early. So I think people are at different levels of understanding the importance of tuning in while we accomplish in the world and we create, but the people who have what I call double vision, where they're in tune with themselves while they are moving in the world, I believe have a really big advantage.
We call it alignment, or we call it soul alignment, which is a little bit more of a spiritual term for it, but it's essentially mind, body, spirit connection, and that we're all in alignment. And it's, you know, very similar to what you're saying, that, you know, this isn't isolated, right? You know, I guess in medicine, we call it whole systems thinking and whole systems, you know, where you're looking at the whole picture. You're not just looking at why did this person get cancer? Or, you know, I also think of, I personally think, and we talk about this a lot, you know, if you're not stepping into your life purpose at a certain age, something will happen. The universe will show up in a way that knocks you on your, you know, knocks you on your butt. Really, this happens all the time. We see it. I mean, it could be cancer. It could be loss of a job. It could be suddenly, right, you know, you've got to move locations. It doesn't really matter what it is, but the universe comes knocking strong and loud and says, wake up. step into your purpose.
Well, I tried to make every encounter in the hospital. So I think one of the biggest things we're missing in our medical world is that we only focus on people's physical ailment, and we use the physical and intellectual worlds to be the levels at which we engage. And so I'm writing a book on burnout, and in that, one of the final chapters is called The Sacred Exchange. And so this one is for healers, self-care and healthcare. So what I say is the reason we've all lost our energy, our purpose and meaning is not because we're not healers and we don't love what we do. It's that when we're overburdened by how many patients we need to see, and it really is only about the physical and intellectual connection there, like, and we have this moment where someone is getting better. They're now going to be discharged. And I call that the sacred exchange. This moment where that my heart was cracked open during burnout, right? But for them, their heart is cracked open by this diagnosis that woke them up. And I wrote something called the awareness prescription. So why this? Like, why a heart attack? Why not my liver, or my lung, or my left leg? Like, why did this part of my body break down? The second question is, why now? Why not 3 years ago? Why not 2 weeks from now? Why? What message did my body need me to get in this moment? Third question is, since hindsight's 2020, what signals might I have missed along the way that make perfect sense now? And question number four, what else in your life needs to be healed? And question number five is, if you spoke from the heart, what would you say to me? And those are the questions I used to leave my patients with the night before I would discharge them. And I called it the awareness prescription just because back then I had a prescription pad in my pocket. I would pull it out and I started writing these questions for them, and I would give it to them and say, if you answer these questions and journal about them overnight and the nurse calls me tomorrow, I'll give you an extra 20, 30 minutes to figure out how not to meet me here again, not in the emergency room. You can meet me in the theater, the grocery store. I'd be happy to meet you other places. But if you want to figure out how not to be here, please journal on these and you and I'll figure that out together. And that was when I had really discovered through my burnout that our inability to communicate makes us physically ill. Not every time, but when I talk about our inability to communicate, I mean, when our head is running the show, it's bullying our body, our heart, our spirit, and it's just saying, I got to do this thing. And it's at all costs, it's moving forward. It's when, we're disconnected in our lives, like we were talking about, whether it's from purpose and meaning, whether it's to the people that we care about in our lives. It's when we buried grief, when we buried disappointment and grief, and we won't look at it. We think we can just skip right over it. But the truth is, avoiding conflict. So let's say you and I got in an argument, okay? Or maybe you don't even know about it, but I didn't like what you said about me in some meeting that we were in. So now there's this conflict between me and you. And it's between us, except you don't really know about it because I'm avoiding conflict. And so what happens in that moment is it doesn't go away. It just shifts position. So it's not between us anymore. I've literally swallowed it. And it now goes inside me, and conflict is now in here. Every time I see you, every time your name pops up in my email, every time I walk by you, I start fighting myself because I want to know how come I didn't say anything? And now it becomes this inner turmoil. And so people have this idea that when they're in conflict with other people, if they just avoid it or sit on it or don't say anything, it'll go away. And I'm like, oh no, that becomes a ticking time bomb inside you.
And it turns into passive aggressive behavior without you even realizing it.
Yeah. And then it's like a beach ball that you push under the deep end of the water and you're holding it there. And lactic acid starts building up in your arm because it hurts so much to do it. And all of a sudden it comes flying up at the most inopportune moment. And you're in the middle of dinner at Thanksgiving saying, yeah, well, let me tell you, right? And everybody's like, okay, get a grip, right? So it's really about, are we willing to pick up signals earlier? And by that, I mean like our physiology, our physical signals, my heart racing, my stomach turning. For me, it's like throat constriction and my stomach dropping. And I know instantly in that moment that there's something I need to be saying that I'm not saying. But for many years, I mean, I got put under anesthesia. I got scoped by multiple doctors because I was convinced that there was like a mass growing in my throat. And they finally were like, oh, you're a medical student? You're just stressed. And I felt so silly that I didn't understand that this was my body's stress response.
Yeah.
You know, no one really teaches us to tune in.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's really interesting that you bring up the voice or really, you know, speaking your truth, because, you know, we work with a lot of women and, you know, obviously there's many men too. I don't want to isolate it to women only, but, you know, women particularly have faced through conditioning of many years and across many cultures, right, in the West and in the East, where they've been afraid to voice their truth, speak their truth in a boardroom, or even in a, you know, even in a situation and in a family relationship situation, right? Where you're in the kitchen and you're afraid to speak up because the brothers and the father may say something. Yeah. And then you have that internal conflict and conversation that you were just talking about. Mm-hmm. And so they hold it in, and, you know, it may not necessarily move into physical disease, right? But it could manifest in a myriad of other unhealthy ways. And we see that a lot.
Yeah. What you're saying really rings true to what happened to me when I lived in New York too, when I was married. I was very unhappy. I was going nonstop, exercising nonstop, trying to be a father, a husband, practicing yoga, lifting, kung fu, until one day my body said, no mas, no more, Anthony, it's done. And I just completely shut down. I went into neuropathic pain throughout my entire mouth, my hard palate, soft palate. I had things going in my brain and my head. I had CAT scans, MRIs done, and they couldn't figure out what was going on. And the only thing I could do was literally sit and just meditate. I couldn't even move anymore. I had to completely slow down to nothing. Mm-hmm. And that was my heart opening, my spiritual awakening to say, Anthony, it's time to slow down. Because I used to say, I'm going to slow down when I die. And that's what happened. I physically died, spiritually died. And I wish that other people, as they're going through this, that they can see these signs, because it's so hard to see that until something happens to you. Yeah. And hopefully you become aware of it, that now when, if I'm going a little bit too fast or doing too much, I still have the neuropathic pain throughout my mouth. And I'm like, okay, slow down.
And you meditate when that happens.
And I'll meditate, yeah. Yes.
You know, I love the idea of your journaling, because yeah, journaling is so powerful. I mean, you know, we recommend it for things like manifestation, right? Because it's, you know, it's an automatic for manifestation to get out what you really want to create and desire in your life. But for those signals, right, you know, to actually figure out what those signals are, because that was one of the first questions you asked yourself on Burnout 101, not Burnout 201, but Burnout 101, what signals did I miss? And I think that's, you know, it's invaluable advice to people, to your patients, and obviously to everyone who's listening too, because journaling, suddenly,
yes,
if you can't speak it, you get it down and it's very therapeutic, and you're sitting there and you're looking at it. And then suddenly it's like, wow.
Yeah.
How did I miss this?
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. I think however it gets expressed, it needs to come out of us, right? And so I think the idea that whether you write it, whether you speak it, that's what I was speaking about with the sacred exchange, we're in this rat race where we're got to see more patients, more patients. It's all about speeding up. It's almost like we've taken the word efficiency, which is a strength. It's a strength to be efficient, but I always say a weakness is just a strength overused. And so when you are pushing efficiency to the point of losing effectiveness, you've now lost what it is that you're doing. And so in the hospital, working with patients, to me, there's a place where there's this sacred moment where you've helped them through some milestone in their life that has the chance to wake them up. And there's sacred exchange happens. And this is what most people use it for. Take two pills twice a day and I'll see you in the office in 2 weeks. It's like, what? Like, what just happened? And we wonder why patients don't make, you know, the $1 trillion question in healthcare is why. How do we inspire and engage our patients to take personal accountability to make the choices that are good for them when they're not in my office? And the way I believe we do that is by taking that sacred exchange, that moment when they're getting better and they're doing well, and to ask them important questions to help them connect the dots between their physical health and everything else in their life. Because if stress causes or exacerbates more than 90 to 95% of all illness, the question of what's at the root of your stress is going to help you decrease that, turn off your own adrenaline system and stress and cortisol. Like, we need to calm our own selves in the everyday space rather than relying just on doing whatever we want as fast as we want and then asking someone else to numb the signals that are coming in once they start. And so when the medical world, when you get a clean bill of health from the medical world, which I always suggest is the first thing you should do, move into asking yourself some questions about what else might be going on that could be contributing to physical symptoms.
But doesn't that come from, you know, sadly, it comes from, I'll call it an outdated paradigm, which is this aspect of siloed medicine, right? Mm-hmm. So when that happens and it comes up, the doctor may think, well, that's out of my jurisdiction. Send it to a psychologist or a neurologist or, you know, any other specialty but me. This is kind of where I sit, opposed to really moving into, or, you know, people call it leaning into now, right? Where you're leaning into truly understanding beyond what's your scope, right? And that's just called caring. It's called caring enough to take the time, right? Rather than looking at the watch to see how quickly you can get the patient out of your office, to really get them to feel what's going on. Mm-hmm. And to see where the connections are, right? And that doesn't happen in traditional healthcare.
Well, you have to think about why this is going on. It's a me, we world. So by nature, I believe most people who have gone into medicine, nursing, healthcare, by nature, they're healers. By nature, they're drawn to something incredibly hard for giving up their youth to learn how to do this and serve. I came out of school when I was 31 years old. So you give up your youth and you spend all the years before you even get in trying to aspire for this, you know, level of healing and service. So at our hearts, we care and we're purpose driven, but there's a weight that starts coming on us when hundreds of thousands of dollars in loans start piling up. There's all of our friends are moving on. They're starting their lives. They're getting married. They're having kids. We haven't even gotten out of school yet. We're making $5 an hour in residency. We're working 80 hours. Like, the whole thing is just set up in a very odd way to teach us to override our biology. Then we move into, we had to be autonomous and compete to get to the best program, the best residency, the best. Then we get thrown in, and here's where we go from me to we. We get thrown in a hospital, a team, a practice, and they're like, okay, you were autonomous until now. That's how you got here. Now play like a team. And we're like, a team? Like, this is about me. Like, I've got to get here. Like, no one's really taught us that. So there's the me, you know, how much an individual can take. Then there's the we, which is like, what do you mean all of us together? And then there's the world, which is the world of healthcare, which has all these efficiencies and giving us targets and metrics, 60 minutes from emergency department to floor. And so we always got here because we got an A and we followed the rules and we did it right. And so here we are trying to get an A for the hospital, for our team, for our department, for now they're linking it to bonus and pay. And I mean, it almost is like a setup not to win. Because by nature, we would love to spend time with our patients. By nature, we would, but if we do that, is it okay not to meet the metrics? And is it okay to fail? Failure? Are you kidding? Like, we're like, excuse me, I wear this white coat. My name is Dr. Sangwan, right? Like, I am here because I got an A, right? Like, I'm not here because I'm not going to meet all these hoops you're having me jump through. And I think we go through that until we collapse, just like you did, Anthony, just like I did, right? And then there's a reorienting. The opening of my heart was also getting really clear on what I valued most and in what order I valued it. And so I think, you know, those dark nights of the soul, the moments that people have health breakdowns, you know, when you're there, you slow down. You get clear, and what matters in your life comes into clear focus. Mm-hmm. You know, people say it must be so depressing that when you were in your 20s, you spent it all with people who were sick and dying. And I was like, I never thought of it that way. I thought somebody just gave me a front row seat to the end of the game. I got to sit with people at the end of their life and hear what actually matters.
Beautiful.
And what they would tell me on that deathbed was never that they should have worked more, never that they needed more money. If they had a lot of money, they told me what chaos it created in their life. If they didn't have enough money, they said, you know what? It doesn't matter. What they cared about was, did they love well? Were they loved well? And they talk about regrets, which were usually around not risking.
Not taking risk.
Not taking risk. They were too afraid and they were sad. They should have apologized, but they didn't, you know. So it's like, so I got very clear that it was really about serving others. It was about taking care of myself so I could enjoy this life. And that it was about having the courage to take risks and be, and that was what made me feel alive. And so when people think like, oh God, you know, so sorry that you had to do that, I'm like, no, I kind of think I know what I'm living this life toward, because you live it twice. You live it once forward, and then you live it the second time in reflection. And if I create a great story moving forward for me, that I've risked, I've taken chances, I'm courageous, I love fully, I try things, I make sure I am surrounded by people who love me, that's going to be an awesome conversation.
And an awesome life. I mean, I think, you know, you're essentially talking about the old paradigm is, do you see the glass half full or half empty? And the new paradigm is you see it overflowing. You see it overflowing and brimming with all of these things, and you're turning whatever was perceived to be a negative into a positive and into all of these enriching, flourishing relationships, right? And all of these exchanges that, you know, make us grow as human beings and also make us, like you said, love deeper.
Yeah.
Because, you know, being vulnerable, I'll never forget, you know, when I went through my, you know, 90-hour weeks, 100-hour weeks, and had my health, you know, challenges, right, in the corporate PR and marketing world. And I was sitting there in Las Vegas trying to get to an event and get to this, you know, CNN interview, and, you know, just absolutely broke down in the street in front of a couple of journalists. And, you know, I thought, oh my God, my career is over, right? You know, I've just broken down. I'm not professional. And it was really interesting. I'll never forget. I think he was from CNET, if I recall correctly. And he just looked at me and he had a tear running down his eye. And he said, "Don't you understand, Renee, being vulnerable is the most beautiful thing. And you just gave us that right on the streets here in Las Vegas at 3 o'clock in the morning." And he said, the more that you can be vulnerable, right? The more that you can open and be that, you know, the more that your heart's going to expand. And I don't know, it's probably the age that you went through, 35 or whatever. And I thought, oh, wow. Okay. So being strong is not about carrying the load. You can actually be vulnerable and show who you are to the world. And that was pretty profound, right? And, you know, that's what you teach in all of your work, which is, you know, I do want to address something, you know, speaking of women stepping into purpose, having courage, because you did this years ago, and it was actually what your TEDx talk was with us. And it was so profound. And, you know, you embarked upon this journey to the Middle East unexpectedly. Talk about stepping into, holy cow, right? Do you want to just talk about that a little bit? Because, you know, here you were being sent to the Middle East. It was unexpected. There was a surprise. Mm-hmm. It was shocked you were a woman.
Yeah.
Right. And then your engagement with all the women when you got there. I would love for you to share that with us.
Sure. So it was 2008, and Jim Gordon, one of my mentors, he helps trauma. He transforms trauma. So he's one of the guys that goes in when in Haiti after the earthquake. He, of course, just got back from Ukraine. And right. So he, when everybody else is fleeing, he's moving there. And he helps people tap into their mind-body connection to speak to their stress, to heal their stress together, and bring people together in that place. So he called me and he said, I'd like you to represent me in Saudi. And I was so shocked. I was like, hey, Jim, you're a Harvard-trained psychiatrist. You're a white male. You're 70 years old. Like, at the time, I was 38. I'm like, Indian single woman, do you think the Saudis are going to know it's not me? Like, it's me and it's not you. And he said, no, this will be good. Like, I want you to hold the door open for me. And I said, okay, well, he had written this book called Unstuck, seven steps to getting out of depression without medication. And that had just turned the psychiatry world upside down, and the Saudis loved it. So in this experience, I tell my parents grew up in India amongst a lot of Hindu-Muslim conflict. And so for them, this was very startling. Like, what do you mean? You're going to Saudi Arabia as a single woman. You're going to, you know, teach men and women in healthcare how to communicate. Like, the hired help is Indian. Like, what are you doing? And my mom was quite afraid and said, you know, I'd have to call the State Department and make sure that you're going to be okay. And so I started getting nervous, and I called Jim back and said, hey, Jim, I don't think it's a good idea. And he said, come on, Neha, I think you're just afraid. I think what you need to do is call the other three men, some of them, and get to know them who are going on the trip. Get to know them better so that when you get there, everybody's not, you know, strangers. You have some people that you feel comfortable with. So I wrote an email to Paul Roche, who was the head of the American Institute for Stress. And I said, hi, Paul. Neha, I'm coming in place of Jim Gordon. There's four of us total going. I'm wondering, you know, have you ever been to Saudi? Has anyone been to Saudi? So he writes back in all capital letters, and he writes, I'm disappointed that Jim won't be coming. That's too bad. I was really looking forward to knowing him better. It's my first time. I think it's everyone's first time, Paul.
Super helpful.
Yeah. And I was like, wow, you know what? This man is so condescending. I cannot believe, you know, he doesn't want me to go. He wishes I was, you know, in the boys club. Like, I started having all these thoughts and getting nervous. But then I went and I taught a class about communication at one of the companies I was working at. And one of the things I teach about is you always have to match the level of your communication with the level of importance. And what I had realized is, so we're looking at each other. If you're watching this on video, then you're getting body language, tone, words. That's how we're communicating. We're getting a lot of information from each other. When we are not on video, but we're on a call or audio only, we're getting tone and words. When we text or Slack or chat each other or email, we're only getting words. And what I had done is I took something that was really important to me and I wrote an email. And so I had very little information. So when I taught everybody this, that you have to match level of communication with the method of importance, the method of communication with the level of importance, I was like, oh, so I went home and I picked up the phone because I was in California and he was in New York. And I said, hi, Paul, this is Neha. You know, the emails we've been sending back and forth, I noticed that they were all in capital letters. What does that mean? And he said, oh, sweetie, when you get to be 86 years old, I can't see worth a darn. So I put everything in capital letters so that I can read what I'm sending you. And I was like, oh my gosh, I made up so many stories that weren't true. So in the end, we get there and I meet him in the lounge. And by the way, though, I will say the Saudis were quite gracious. There is a separation between men and women. They were on my flight. They just were all in first class and I was in business class. So three men, right? First class, I'm in business class. They all came to the lounge with roses from first class saying, we had a feeling you were on this flight, but we had a feeling we didn't see you like with us. And so I felt really seen and heard by them. I went through the conference and it was astounding because the first time I went, I've gone twice, but the first time I went, I was in front of the men. I was the only woman speaker because the Saudis really value the host-guest relationship. And so they value Jim Gordon. So if Jim wants to send me, you're not going to say no to who Jim is sending if you ever want Jim there again, right?
Good point.
So, yeah. So all the men were in a room and I was speaking. They were very gracious. They included me with everything with the speakers. And the women were in the hotel, but in another wing of the hotel watching me on video. So I thought, wow, the separation here is like very real. So I am now teaching the women. I asked if I could do a workshop with the women only. They were so excited, right? They can take off their burqas and abayas and things. But anyway, we go into this session and they all are covered up. And I'm giving the session and I'm talking about communication and I'm giving examples and I'm doing something like I almost, you know, that I just did with you. You got to match, you know, the level of communication with the level of importance, et cetera. But about, I don't know how far in, but all of a sudden I could hear things in my, like this, you can't talk to them about their culture. What you're saying doesn't really relate to them. All these voices started happening in my head. And I slowed down and I stopped and I said, hey guys, I want to know if what I'm saying is actually connecting. Is this helpful? And they were like, oh yes, Dr. Sangwan, it's so helpful, so helpful. And it was in that moment that I realized how odd it was to be in front of people, but not be able to see their body language or response or get any feedback. And so I was having this almost the equivalent of somebody like nothing.
Because they were covered, because they were covered in burqas.
Yeah, they were covered. And all I could see, right, was this. And so I couldn't tell. And so I remember that day realizing how much I depend on your feedback, your visual clues to know that I'm making an impact, that I'm on track. And that was one of the days that I said, wow, Neha, I still think you're a little too focused outward rather than trusting your inner self. And then I thought, when will I ever use this? This isn't even relevant in our world. And then I came back and I walked into the operating room and I was like, oh, we're missing so much communication. We're, you can hear us, but we're mumbled. And I walked into the hospital. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is enormous. I've never spoken about it. And then COVID. And the whole world is walking around, not being able to see each other and all of this. And I just remember thinking, all the judgments we make about each other for what we think is okay or not okay. So now I'm on the seventh day there. I'm at the final day. And I get a phone call that they say, we're taking the speakers falcon hunting. Prince Abdulaziz would like you to join with the speakers, and we're going to go falcon hunting. And I was like, okay, so I'm vegetarian. I know this is a big deal. I know they're inviting me with all the men. Like, this is a big deal. So the answer is yes. Yes, I'm coming. But I just remember how much anxiety was happening for me. And we go out in the dunes, and we're in the desert, and there's a whole caravan of like 7-10 SUVs, everybody following. One of the, you know, SUVs has pigeons. The next one has falcons. The next one has like rugs and coffee and dates and Arabian tea, like everything that's going to get set up after the experience. So we go out, I meet Prince Abdulaziz, we go falcon hunting, et cetera. And we're done. And I have a book from Jim Gordon that's signed for him. And I walk over where they lay out these beautiful rugs. And I walk over to the prince and I say, I'd like to give you a gift from Dr. Gordon. And he says, Neha, sit down. Like, I want to talk to you. He said, you might not understand our traditions, but on the rug, this is like our version of camping. You guys all go camping and sit around a bonfire, and we're in the desert. There's like nothing around except, you know, the sand and these rugs, and there's cushions and things, and people are serving us Arabian tea and coffee and dates and things. So I sit down. He said, yeah, anything goes. So you can ask whatever questions on your mind. Like, it's about just being free and open. And I said, oh, okay. He said, so I'd like to ask you a question, right? What has the media taught you about our culture that you find to be true? And what has the media taught you about our culture that after 7 days here, you find not to be true?
Oh, great questions.
And so it's one of those moments where you're like, how honest am I going to be? Like, where am I going with this, right? And I thought, well, he's asking me, so I'm gonna answer. I said, well, the separation of men and women is true. I saw it not only in society, but I saw it at the conference. But what I will say is, you know, you were very gracious in allowing me to go between the two. So I got to hang out with the men and the speakers and do what they were doing. And then I went and I hung out with the women. That had never happened before. So I said, I really appreciated that. The other thing that I found not to be true was the media has always taught me that women feel really repressed and suppressed underneath their burqas and abayas, and they're being made to do it. But when I asked them about it, maybe a quarter of them said, this is all I've ever known. I feel protected. I feel that I am anonymous and I can have any emotional response I want and nobody sees it. So I feel actually protected from the unwanted attention of men. And I feel that I have power because I can express myself emotionally and nobody knows. And I was like, wow, that was shocking to me. So, I said, you know, the other thing that surprised me is that, that's really the media experience. So then he said, oh, you know, okay. And I said, well, if anything goes, then that means I get to ask you a question too. And he said, sure. And I said, why is it that I'm a woman at 38 who doesn't cover my head all the time? Sometimes I wear skirts. I date men that I haven't married. Like, the women in this culture would go to have the moral police would take them to jail for the things that I have done. Why is it that you treat me with such honor and respect? And so he smiled and he said, okay, I cheated. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, when we heard you were coming in place of Jim Gordon, we were very concerned about what your intentions were around communication. But when I got word that when you got off the plane, you had a black scarf around your head, in that moment, I knew that it was not my job to make you part of this culture. It was my job to honor the culture from which you come.
Nice.
And in that moment, we decided that we were including you in everything. We were bringing you to everything because we felt that your intention was to honor us. And that was probably the biggest lesson I learned, which was if you really, really want something from someone else, you want respect from them, you want them to understand you, you want them to listen to you. The secret to doing it is giving it away first. Give them respect. Seek to understand them. Listen deeply to them, because that is the most natural and easy path to someone being interested in you. And so I didn't do it intentionally, but yeah.
Well, you understood your intuition.
Yeah.
That was your intuition rising to the surface and letting you know intuitively, right? Noetically, whatever you want to call it, that that was what you needed to do to not just survive in Saudi Arabia, but thrive. And wow. You know, that's exactly what happened, right? You were listening to that inner compass.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was quite incredible. And 2 years later, they invited me back. And this time it was interesting. They had progressed because when I was on stage, Al Jazeera's filming.
Yeah.
And now everybody's in the same room. So I can see the men over here, the women over here, except there was a huge barrier between them, a wall. They couldn't see each other.
Oh, wow.
And I was quite nervous. I was quite sensitive about being on national television. And so I took that scarf and I put bobby pins in and I tried to do it properly. And when I was just about to come up and speak before that, I went and asked the religious leaders who were sitting on stage. I looked at them and I said,
is this right?
Right. Is this okay? And so they said, yes, like, you know, it looks good. So I'm on stage for about 30 minutes. And I don't know, about 5 minutes before I'm supposed to finish, I don't feel any tension on my head anymore. And so I'm speaking, I'm giving my talk, but I'm a little bit nervous because I'm not feeling anything, right? And I look to the religious leader and I kind of go to my head and he's like, no, it's okay, finish. And so I finished. And then as I finished, I ran off the stage to go to the bathroom to get my, what had fallen off and try to put it back on. And I guess as I ran out in Arabic, he said to the entire audience of hundreds of people, if the world showed up this way with sincerity and care for one another, we would have world peace.
Mm.
And I remember that it wasn't what happened. It was that they knew my intention was to be respectful. And that changed everything. And then a flood of women just ran into the bathroom. They're like, did you hear what the religious leader said about you? You made a mistake and it was okay. It was, I mean, they didn't even know what to do with themselves, right? And so now every 2 years, there is one female speaker at that conference.
Bravo, right?
That's like my little change. You know, I always feel like if we can make just a little tweak in the world. But many people said to me, go in there, teach their women, get them all riled up, you know, and it just didn't feel like the right approach. And I felt that that was disrespectful. And I think that the way, not always, I think sometimes there's like people should fight when things are egregious, but I do feel that the path there might be counterintuitive, but with respect and listening and understanding we can find our way to each other's hearts.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, I love that. I mean, you know that I run an online travel magazine, and actually just in October spoke on stage at the Travel and Adventure Show, the largest travel show in North America. And it was their first physical event since the pandemic. And, you know, it was all about transformative travel. And a big part of the message of the talk that I gave was exactly what you just said is, you know, that we really have to, when we go, it's sacred land, it's sacred customs. All of these things are an integral part of who they are, their language, right? It says so much about them. And, you know, I've had so many situations over the years with precisely that. You know, I remember going to Hungary and meeting with a new client, one of whom was the only venture capitalist in Hungary, like the only one, not just in Budapest, but all of Hungary. And it was, you know, eight men in a room and me. Yeah. And, you know, we were there, they were trying to get me drunk for 3 days, not to take advantage of me, but just that was part of their custom. We're going to drink wine together. We're going to do food together. You're going to taste all of our wines. You're going to taste, you know, you're going to taste our food. We're going to go through this whole process. And I'm like, whiteboard guys, you know, I come from the West and I'm really, you know, just trying to understand this is not productive. You're kind of giving me more money than you need to, you know, we're 3 days before we're even getting to it. And my, you know, my daily rate is expensive. They didn't care. This was part of their custom.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's been similar with other, you know, entrepreneurs that I've worked with, you know, even in France. And, you know, so, you know, I learned that in business and through travel. I went to a Bedouin camp in Israel. And, you know, I did have to put the shawl around my and sit over with the women, right? Where the men had their own camp around the fire. So we learn these things through modeling. Physiology is so important, right? As you said, to be able to model that. But that is so important for us all to observe and to show and be respectful, even if it doesn't make sense to us. And I think it's amazing, right? That over 10 years ago now, you went there as a woman, stood your ground, was respectful, and was, you know, able to get the changes that occurred. I mean, it's just, you know, I hope everyone who's listening, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring that story up. I know it was a long time ago, but it's really kind of indicative of who you are and how you teach, mm-hmm. right? And teaching about communication. So anyway, bravo, bravo.
I love what you're talking about because I am by profession a speech and language pathologist. So I understand about the nonverbal communication, when you don't have those cues, it's very difficult to try to interpret what the body language is, because so much of the messages that we are trying to understand come from a person's body language.
Yeah.
Not just from the words, but probably about 80 to 90% is coming from a person's body language. And when you're covered up, it's very difficult to see that.
Yeah.
I was working with the little kids and their mouths are covered. I'm like, I can't see their mouth trying to imitate sounds and things of that nature. The other point that I really liked, because I am a cultural speech and language pathologist, is that when you go into a culture, you must show the utmost respect for these individuals and understand where they're coming from. And when you're able to do that, and you talk about the heart, not only does your heart open up, but their heart opens up as well to yours. And then you see this communication going and this willingness to communicate with each other.
Yeah.
The respect for each other's culture is truly an heart opening, and you nailed it on the head. It was perfect.
Well, and I also think, you know, this is the work that Thomas Hubel does. You're probably familiar with this, you know, about trauma, of healing the collective land, right? And so forward, backwards, you know, healing between Palestinians, he's working with Israelis and other parts of the world as well. And that trauma really bringing these cultures together to understand each other.
Again, I'll say as a channeler, the guides will say, touch one soul at a time. And that's exactly what you did. You touched one soul and you made an incredible difference. It just blossomed outward. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was amazing. Wow. So we have been all over the globe today. We've been to Saudi Arabia, right? The history from India, your work on the East Coast, West Coast. So you do a lot outside of the traditional medical world as well, right? So you're a traditional MD and you do a lot in ER and so forth, but you also work with corporations, right? And getting them to communicate in a way that's healthy, uncover the trauma, uncover the disconnect. So do you want to talk to us a little bit about the system that you've developed, or at least that you call the I5 conversation, and maybe a few examples after you explain it, a few examples of what is most relevant for the last few years, right? We've been in the pandemic. And maybe a business example and a personal example of using and implementing that I5 conversation.
Great. So the first book that I wrote is called Talk Rx, and Talk Rx or Talk Prescription, 5 Steps to Honest Conversations That Create Connection, Health, and Happiness. The reason I wrote that book is that it seems that the world has such a difficult time having authentic conversations, speaking in a clear and concise way, and speaking compassionately. So some people say, well, I'm honest. Let me tell you, you look ugly in that shirt. I'm just being honest. I actually believe that authenticity is really about being honest with compassion, because honesty without compassion is brutality. And so how is it that we can be clear, concise, compassionate, and authentic as we connect to one another? So as I thought through this, as I went through it for myself, the reason I'm so passionate about this is for the first 30 some years of my life, I was shut down and didn't express my emotions, didn't know how to communicate. And that damaged my relationships. It hindered my ability to handle conflict at work, to be close to my mom and express what was going wrong, you know, in our family or at the dinner table every day. And over time that builds up. And so that's why this healed me, as I then got to help heal others. And I now do this in the world. So the first thing that you have to do, and I have a model with the diagram of the body. And on the top floor, I imagine that we're all individual skyscrapers, each one of us. We're aspiring to be the best we can, reaching for the sun. Each human is a skyscraper. On the top floor, I want you to imagine the body. And it's also the outline of your body. So the top floor and the outline. That's your data gathering machine. It picks up data externally in the world, body language, tone, and words, anything you see, touch, taste, smell. It's like this human machine just picking up data. The other way the body picks up data is internally, through your physiology, heart racing, stomach turning, throat tightening, jaw clenching. So there's internal data coming in and there's external data. When you get in the elevator and you drop down to the next floor, which is your thoughts, most of us have a penthouse here. We spend so much time here. It's so well decorated. It's like this thing is the highlight of everything, right? And so get back in the elevator, and that floor is about integrating your internal and external data and how you form your thoughts. And depending, there's so many ways you do it, but depending which of those versions you choose to believe, you get back in the elevator and you drop down into your heart. And this is the emotions floor. And in the emotions floor, when this opens, most people, there's like no floorboards. They haven't been there. There's cobwebs. There's danger signs going, don't go here. Anytime we end up on this floor, we actually run out the fire escape and try to make sense of it from the body or the thoughts section. Let's talk our way out of it. Let's maneuver our way out of it. So get back in the elevator and you go down, and then it opens in your abdomen. And that would be the desire floor. What do you want? What is it that you'd like to create in the world? And to me, desires are not just what you want. It's why you want that. If I want $1 million, the question is, what will that give me if I have it? So it's what you want, desires equal what you want, and then what you value about that want. Then you get back in the elevator and you go all the way down. And now this is where you put the other four levels together and you can take action and have a conversation with someone else. So I'm going to go over that one more time. Body, drop down, thoughts, drop down, heart and emotions, drop down, what do you want? So the data comes in, you interpret it, you feel something, you want something. Now it's time to have a conversation and make agreements with other people. So an example would be, in the last few years, if I'm a leader at work and I'm thinking, if I let my workforce not come in, so I'm going to go through if I was going to have this conversation, right? Oh gosh. We're so disconnected. I'm worried about our morale. People are quitting. I'm losing people. I better make everybody come back in. I don't want this hybrid thing because we're so disconnected. So I want to have everybody come in. Now, if I'm thinking about having this conversation with my team, the first thing I better think about is, what's the level of importance of this conversation? Pretty high. So I better be using don't send out an email, everybody get back in. Okay, that's very low communication. It's words only when it's really high importance. So I better be doing a live town hall. It better be recorded, right? We want all the visual cues here. If I'm there, I'm thinking to myself, okay, data. Five key people have left. I noticed that some companies are bringing their people back. Other companies are having vaccination mandates. Other companies are not. They're doing testing and checking for temperatures, et cetera. My thoughts are, I'm really worried about this great resignation. I'm really thinking our people are disconnected and they're not as engaged. And by the way, I think they get away with a lot while they're at home. I'm not sure they're really working. I think they're like, you know, working out and hanging out and sunning and getting a tan or whatever's going on. So I think they're coasting. What I feel is panic because I'm looking at my bottom line and I'm thinking my company's falling apart. That was another thing. My company's going to fall apart if I allow this to happen. So now I'm into the emotion section and I'm feeling anxious, panicked, a little angry, taken advantage of. Like I'm feeling some angst. Then I go down to the desire space. How do I want to show up in this meeting? I want to show up curious. I want to show up present. I want it to be an exchange. So now I'm moving into a little bit of a better place where I'm thinking, what do I want how do I want this to end up being for everybody? And so the first thing I do is I think about how I would show up. Then I think about how I want to feel about it when I'm done. And then I put it all together. So now in that want section, it's also, what do I want to know? So I want to know how they feel about this. I also want to know, would they feel more engaged if they came in? So then if I had the conversation, it would sound like this. Hey guys, I'm so glad you're at the town hall today. You know, I noticed that some companies are bringing people back. Some people are coming up with a hybrid. Some people are not back at all until next year. I've had some thoughts going on in my head that are conflicting. On one hand, I think the reason some people have left is because we're disengaged. On the other hand, I think that if we all came back, we would feel more connected again. I also know that some of you are afraid of bringing COVID back home to your families. There's a part of me that's feeling anxious. And I'd like to hear what you think. I'd like us to have an honest dialogue. I'm leaning towards having people come back, but I'd like to hear what you all want to have happen. in that place in a pretty short amount of time now, I have some awareness of all of this, and it should be pretty clear to you listening where I am.
Nice. Yep.
Right. And so at home, what I'd say is the political divide around the dinner table has become pretty intense.
You think?
And we've kind of entrenched ourselves in our own corners. And what I'd say is I shouldn't be so surprised, but now that I look back, I have realized that I'm not really surprised. It's just that people have become more transparent.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah.
It's not shocking. No one really went off the rails and became someone they weren't. They just started feeling more confident saying certain things and making certain stands. And so at the dinner table, what I would say, let's imagine that, you know, my sister and I disagree, or my father and I disagree on politics. And so what I have said, I'll tell you how it came out for me. Hey, Dad, I know that you've mentioned several times that you grew up in a time of Hindu-Muslim conflict when you were growing up. I also understand that the fear you felt when you were a little boy, when India was broken apart and there was all these fightings and fires and burning each other's villages and homes down, was something that you never talked about in your growing up. And really, you never talked about it until I asked you about it. So I really get that that was a trauma for you. When you say hurtful things about generalizing an entire billion people, what I think to myself is, Dad, you're undoing the work that I am spending my life doing in the world. I want to connect people, help us see that we're really one. And when you say, make generalizations like the one you just made, and I would say what it is, I feel hurt. I feel distanced. I feel unappreciated and unvalued, and I feel disconnected from you. And so what I want to do is ask you a few things. One is there anything that I'm missing here? The second one is, when we're together, could you please have some awareness around your comments, my presence, and maybe become more specific about something that upset you rather than making generalizations? That could really work for me. And maybe ask some questions about, to get curious about what might be different than it was 60 years ago or 70 years ago. Because I have friends, clients, people I love that are Muslim. And so I've grown up with a different experience and I didn't have that trauma. So I'd like to feel close to you and connected and to be able to have real conversations. So would you be willing to do any of those things? And I'm willing to hear what I might have missed.
Yeah, that's great.
And that's the value of body, thoughts, emotions, desires, and putting it together. Because you should have a pretty clear idea of how I pieced that all together. And then if somebody's across from you and you're feeling a little confused about what they mean, how do you know that? What do you think about that? How are you feeling? What do you want? Why do you want it? Those are the questions you could ask someone else to help them get clear if you're on the listening end and you're not sure what's happening, yeah. Right? So it's not only getting clear yourself and being concise, it's about you knowing what question to ask the other person for clarity. Yeah, it's like a framework, you know, when the world is so reactive and so angry, it's helpful to have like just a framework to follow to keep you, you know, in a place where you can form your thoughts, you can communicate. Because as soon as communication breaks down, we don't have, and curiosity breaks down, we don't actually have a bridge to each other anymore.
Yeah, that's so true, right? I mean, when we we can feel each other, right? You know, when we can feel each other, sense each other, that that person is like me, even if it's in a very, very, very little way.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think what you did, again, with the example you brought in with your father.
Yeah, it was great.
You did also, I believe it was in Saudi Arabia with the prince. You, again, you showed this, this great amount of respect.
Yeah.
And you spoke to their heart, not so much to their brain, but to their heart. And you were able to have this, again, this heart coherence, this giving back and forth to each other. And when you're able to do that, you can really start to see the human being that is in front of you. And yeah, that's the true connection when you're speaking, you might say, to the soul or to that person's higher self. And yeah, that's the most important rule there is, I think, for communication whenever you're speaking to anybody, that remembering who this person is, it's not just this physical being, but it's something much more. And you seem to have captured that perfectly.
Right. And doing it in a way that kind of makes sense for corporations, yeah, and institutions, because in the work that we do, it's very spiritual. So, you know, it's interesting you brought up all these things. Some of them actually correlate to the chakras, right? You know, the emotions, yeah, the desires is the solar plexus and all of that. But, you know, in order for us to, Anthony calls it code switching, have them hear us, we can't say, well, you know, come on, let's get your solar plexus like open. That's not going to work. So, you know, we do have to code switch all the time in society. So, you know, super powerful and effective ways that you come up with to really do that. It's, you know, it's kind of like the, I see you, I feel you, I hear you.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And I have to say, please, I am certainly not perfect at this. My family will tell you, right? There are times when that is not what the conversation sounds like. So I really want to acknowledge that when I, you know, slow down enough to connect and I'm not reactive in those moments, it's great to know how to do it, because I think a lot of people don't know how to do it. And so it feels like this amorphous space. You know, something else I just want to bring up too is I disagree with a lot of people that are very smart. And so what I realize is the rational space is being bypassed. And I think a lot of our disagreements and things have to do with unhealed wounds. And we're a society that wants a quick fix. We're a society that wants a Band-Aid and numb that symptom and all of that. And I think what our divide is showing us is that if we don't go back and actually heal the wounds, like for my father with his childhood, and, you know, all of us have wounds that could be healed more or another level or whatever. So I'm not saying there's people who have wounds healed and people who don't, but there certainly are people who look externally more than they reflect internally. And in that space, I think it's pretty easy to use fear to channel straight through to getting them to action or doing things that their thinking mind normally wouldn't do. And so I think this piece about how much energy and time we spend on our inner world as we are in the outer world is really coming to, like, it's revealing how little time we've spent there. And I believe that that is one of our ways back home.
Oh, yeah. So beautifully said, right? I mean, I think in a way, it's kind of an aching, a calling for help, a collective consciousness mm-hmm. that's reaching out and calling for help, saying, no, no more divide, right? Mm-hmm. This is time for oneness now, time for us to all come together. And, you know, I think the work that you are doing, bravo, bravo, right, is really making it more than acceptable. It's making it acceptable, but it's actually making it very okay to be vulnerable and say, we need to talk about this stuff, right? It's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to be in our heart place. It's okay to say that we've got trauma, because everyone does.
Right.
We're not alone.
The problem is your biology won't let you do it if you don't feel safe.
You don't.
Your biology will literally protect you. If you don't know how to do something, if you've done it before and it caused someone to leave or to break a relationship that mattered to you, that pain stays stored inside you and will not let you do it again because the risk is too high. And so, you know, you were speaking of diversity and people who look differently and, you know, than other people. I mean, what I recognized that shocked me was I said to my dad, "Dad, do you realize that most people don't know the difference between you and someone Muslim?" And he said, "Of course they do."
Oh, wow.
And I said, "No, Dad, actually they don't." And that leads me to something that I really think is if we don't start to heal ourselves, it feels like as a country, we are having, like we are an enormous autoimmune disease. Mm. We're attacking ourselves, just like our own immune system would attack us. And if we don't get ourselves back into alignment on our inner world, it's going to be really hard for us to find connection in our between us.
Yeah.
And so I hope that this is a wake-up call. You know, in the last few years, I have had autoimmune and food sensitivities and all of that. And what I realized was my giving to other people was not matching my self-care. And I needed to slow down and really align my food, my nourishment, my sleep, all of my rhythms. And now I feel stronger than ever. And that autoimmune experience for me, while it happens on a physical level, what I was asking myself is, how are you not in alignment with yourself as you serve? Because if you can get that alignment physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, when you are doing your work again, it will be on a whole new level. And so I think that's what's being asked of us. We're going to have these cracks in our community, in our country revealed, the underbelly revealed. And the question is, are we going to heal it? You know, or are we going to ignore it, try to bypass it, over it, under it? Like, I just think there's one way right now, and it's through. And the people who, the companies who are going to do well are the ones who upgrade, invest in upgrading their workforces, their teams, human software to meet the rapidly changing external environment. There needs to be a meeting of the inner and outer piece of us.
Yeah, I mean, that's perfectly said, right? It's really, it's bringing the science, the tech, the medical worlds together with the spiritual and esoteric and mystical worlds. And thousands of years ago, as your dad knows, right? You know, across cultures, right? They used to be together.
Yeah.
They were one. Yeah. And they've been, you know, through reductionist and materialist views over hundreds of years now, none of us have felt safe to go to that internal compass anymore. Yeah. And now it's time, right? Now it's time for all of us, right, in this world of work, whatever it happens to be, whether, you know, whether it's an MD, a psychologist, a speech pathologist, right, spiritual teachers, doesn't matter, gym teacher, right? You can do it in each of your own professions by showing up from the heart and allowing these conversations to happen so that that merging of oneness happens again. I mean, that's huge in our work too, right? It's all about the interconnectedness of all things. And I'll end, right? And then we'll just end with one thing that I would be remiss to bring up in all of this, and that's nature, right? And that's why we have the trees behind us, because that's another thing that we've gotten disconnected from, mm-hmm. is nature, from Gaia. And she needs healing too, right? And I think that's part of us. You went back to something that you had just said in your last comment, that you don't always have these moments where you have these healthy conversations with your parents or what have you at the table because you're not quiet enough. And when we're quiet, this goes back to the wisdom from every single mystical teacher, mage, sage, you know, has said, and that's about being in the present moment, right? Wayne Dyer, same thing, present moment. And, you know, has it ever occurred to you that when we're in the present moment, we can't be angry, we cannot be judgmental, right? Because in that present moment, there is just the I am who I am. Mm-hmm. Right? There just is that beautiful sense of serenity, peace, and oneness that we feel. It's really where our conversation started a little over an hour ago, right? And that is the expansiveness that you spoke about.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Dr. Neha, for being here and doing the work that you're doing, because myself as a speech and language pathologist, I deal with communication. As a spiritual teacher, I deal with communication, and you're dealing with communication on a whole new level, connecting everyone together in a way that I think is healing the world one soul at a time. And when you do that, it touches the all, everything that is.
The ripple effect.
So yeah, the ripple I say effect. Bravissimo to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much to both of you. What an honor.
Oh, thank you so same much. Same here. Is there any last, you know, just comments, anything you want people to know about your upcoming book, any courses that you've got going on, events, anything like that, that you'd like to close with?
You know, it's the books that are going to be coming out for me are going to be around burnout and how we have a net gain or drain of energy and how do you figure that out? Burnout's this huge topic and it's a global epidemic that even the medical world doesn't know how to handle. And so what I've done is just simplified it into, are you having a net gain or drain of energy in one of five levels? Ask you a few questions, figure out where you're losing energy, and then help you heal that. That's one of the topics for 2023. And then the second one is an upgraded and expanded version of the I5 conversation that will be coming out as well.
Great.
So, yeah, looking forward.
We'll be posting links on the subsequent pages. So great. Everyone tuning in can find out more about your work, where to go, where to find you, and your books as well. So thank you so much. What an incredible conversation.
Thank you.
Yay.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Blue Soul Chats, a podcast that bridges science and spirituality. You can learn more about our work at bluesoulearth.com, studywithspirit.com, and bluesoulmedia.com.
Also, head over to bluesoulsummit.com, where you can watch video interviews, each season tackling a particular topic. We are also at Blue Soul Earth on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Clubhouse.
Join us for a future episode of Blue Soul Chats, where we hope to ignite your soul's journey, expand your awareness, and deepen your consciousness.
Thanks for being here, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and listen to previous episodes in our library.